not particularly fun to be around. In his testimony, Matt Murphy described me as not the warmest person, and a bit too opinionated, as well as overly opinionated. He also made several gendered comments. He didn't like my tone, my pushiness, or my entitledness to be in every meeting. I was very aggressive, too competitive, and I was a cancer. Ted's word. Old reviews were cherry-picked to reveal that some found me territorial, not a team player, and someone who could not own a room. I came to dread when she would come to my office with her notebook and want to talk about things, Juliet said on the stand. She said I was an introvert, but also tough and critical. The press started coming out with its own perspective and augmenting the testimony on Twitter. When the investigator testified, she was not a warm and fuzzy person. That was the crux of her problem. I must say I cheered when I later saw that a reporter wrote, editorial side note, which venture firms do generally attract warm and fuzzy people? Not sure that's part of the job description. They're investing in tech companies, not running a nonprofit to save kittens. The criticism boiled down to, I was too aggressive, and I was not aggressive enough. I was too tough and too weak. I didn't go with the flow, and I didn't assert myself. Maybe in one way they were right. Around those people, who seemed determined to sabotage and undermine me, I tended to shut down. But what came first, my coldness or their dislike? I thought back on the many companies I'd worked at before going into venture capital and how much fun we'd had. Those guys were techies, and sometimes awkward, but they'd respected me and we'd gotten along well and gotten things done. I thought back to moments like laughing with my manager on the plane about the CEO's baseball date invite. Ted and John and Matt never exactly came up with games like Grab Scrab. Or if they did, they didn't include me or the other women. I was glad about one thing that came out in the course of the Ellen's a Drag testimonials. Kleiner's penchant for what's known in Silicon Valley as pattern matching. In other words, in looking for people that fit their culture, employers often ended up maintaining very white, very male companies. I found an online audio recording of John's speech to the National Venture Capital Association, where he emphatically promoted his pattern of success. White male nerds who've dropped out of Harvard or Stanford, and they absolutely have no social life. Alan played it right before a break for dramatic effect. That actually did suck the air out of the room. During the trial, I was sleeping just a couple of hours a night. I was tired, and I was lonely. My lawyers had told us Buddy couldn't attend the trial because, given how much terrible stuff they'd been saying about him in the press, he'd be a distraction. One of John's friends, often quoted by the media, wrote of me on Facebook, essentially, "Clearly she's a liar because her husband was with a man before and now is with her, so they are obviously only out to get money." I hated the way they kept trying to bring up his hedge fund's problems to say that I'd only sued to recoup his losses. As if I didn't have my own money. Or as if he needed me to bail him out. Or as if they could honestly be so shocked by fluctuating fortunes in the investment world. John, as I mentioned, had just lent $18 million to another partner, who, unsurprisingly, was part of the group that blocked my career. Years earlier, Buddy had sued a powerful set of people in his New York co-op, the Dakota, for racial discrimination. He had been president of the co-op board, and what he saw of how the board treated Black, Jewish, and other residents had outraged him. When he bought a unit for his mother, they placed restrictions on it that didn't make sense to him. She was not allowed to have overnight guests in her apartment, not even her husband or adult sons. Another Black resident had to take the freight elevator with her dogs and was not allowed to replace her bathtub. Management claimed every time that these were rules that everyone had to follow. but Buddy saw many exceptions. He said he was horrified to hear the board joke about the tub ban, and also about a Latinx applicant being a drug dealer. When they denied his application to buy an adjacent unit, he decided to take action. But he paid a steep price for speaking up. After Buddy filed his discrimination suit, his investors began to receive mysterious calls with wild rumors, scaring them into withdrawing their funds. His business and reputation suffered. At the same time, the law firm Buddy had hired was putting 10 lawyers on call at a time, some of whom charged out at nearly $2,000 per hour. The case just dragged on, and Buddy refused to pay the law firm more than $2.5 million for a year's work. They were demanding $4 million. Thus, my lawyers advised that Buddy not be in the courtroom for my trial, and he was left to follow live accounts from reporters, who transcribed most of the testimony. It was hard. He was frustrated at having to watch the trial from home, and I wished he could be there. But we believed that we had to take the lawyer's advice on how the jury would react to his presence. We carried on, feeling regret that he'd been banished and committed to powering through it. As the weeks wore on, the trial began to exhaust me on every level. I took care of myself the best I could. I continued going to church most Sundays. That helped prepare me for the week to come. And I meditated as much as possible, because I found it rejuvenating. I also developed little tricks for soothing my brain while sitting in court. There would be moments while listening to my former partners talk about how terrible I was when I would visualize a small box. I would imagine myself picking up these horrible statements and all my anger and disappointment and hurt, making them small and tight, and packing them away in that box. I had no idea what I would do with the box, but for now I was focused on compartmentalizing everything that I couldn't process at the time. Sometimes, sitting there, listening to Kleiner partners trash me from the stand, I would think gratefully, at least I don't have to work with him anymore. I had flashbacks to 2012, when things with Kleiner were at their worst and I would spend whole days chanting to myself, I just need to get through the next half hour, just 30 minutes, anything is tolerable for half an hour. I remembered how much I related at the time to the future dystopia movie Gattaca, in which Ethan Hawke's character is asked how he's able to swim farther than his athletically superior brother. He answers, I never saved anything for the swim back. During a trial break, Teresa and I were on the fourth floor, prepping for my testimony. It was the family law floor, where we would see families struggling to stay together. Crying children and teary-eyed parents sat with us, and it was heartbreaking. As I waited in the hallway for Teresa to come out of the ladies' room, I thought briefly about my daughter and my husband, and how lucky I was to have them both. That day I was completely worn out, emotionally, physically, and mentally. And so I straightened my shoulders, blocked out the noises, closed my eyes, and meditated right there, standing in the hallway. Within moments, I sensed a flood of warmth through my whole body. Just a cascade of what felt like fire but didn't burn. It seemed, and may the atheists out there bear with me, distinctly like a religious experience. It wasn't specifically Christian or Buddhist or anything else. But I realized, all of a sudden, I'd reached another level of understanding. I felt supported. I had my family. I had my friends. I'd been hearing from people all over the world about their own experiences of discrimination. I saw the purpose of it all. I just knew everything was going to be okay. From that moment on, I felt less alone and less wedded to the trial's outcome. At the end of my testimony, the judge allowed jurors to ask me questions, just as he did in all his trials. It was a quirky and randomizing process that not many judges used, but it was allowable. I was surprised to learn that the jurors, a a group of 6 men and 6 women, had more than 100 questions, and for 2 hours I answered them. They seemed baffled by the VC lifestyle and genuinely concerned with trying to cut through the legalese. I understood their confusion, and I was happy to explain the ins and outs of the complex VC world. It was much easier to talk with them directly than through Lynn's choppy, frustrating misdirection. One juror asked if it was normal in the VC world for people to send each other urgent emails 24/7, even on holidays. I said yes, and said that making decisions quickly could be very high stakes. Another said, "If you had settled for $10 million, you would have punished Kleiner Perkins, but the issues at the firm wouldn't have been made public. How would the story be told?" I couldn't have put it better myself. One juror asked, "Does a macho environment equate to a discriminatory environment?" All told, I thought their questions were helpful, and I was happy to answer them. It was liberating. I could reply in a normal conversational tone. Certainly, talking to them was much easier than talking to Kleiner's defense lawyer. I could answer questions in full, and no one was intentionally trying to trip me up. A couple of the jurors smiled at me, and I smiled back. The trial proceeded, and I stuck to my approach. I would not inflict collateral damage or play dirty, no matter what Kleiner did. I hadn't asked many people to testify, because I didn't want them to get blackballed for sharing their experiences or to suffer the same way I had. Even though many people had shared information that could have been helpful, including several Kleiner startup CEOs and founders. One said, "Now it all makes sense why you were taken off our startup. I had really wanted to work with you." A woman told me that she had felt disrespected by John when they were on a board together. "Dor never greeted me in any way or looked at me for 2 years." I was told about affairs between partners and about offenses by Kleiner's partners against entrepreneurs, and I kept all of it to myself. I was happy to see that many of the jurors seemed to be reading between the lines. When Kleiner's witnesses testified, the jury asked them some surprisingly thoughtful questions. One juror asked if it was helpful to have an HR policy locked in a drawer. Other jurors asked, "Why aren't there more females? How does an employee argue against subjective comments and goals? Has the VC world fought off women? What is the difference between confident and cocky?" Ted's answer to that was very Ted. The only difference was, if they like you at the end. I had settled into the daily court schedule when on the afternoon of March 13, Friday the 13th, I got a call from my daughter's school. My lawyers had told me the jurors would want to see me in the courtroom every day to show that I was taking the trial seriously, that I was paying attention and was not distracted by my phone or laptop. We were taking a mid-afternoon break when I saw the message and immediately called back. My daughter had had a terrible reaction from her food allergies. Hives, vomiting, breathing difficulties, low pulse, anaphylactic shock. They were taking her in an ambulance to the emergency room. I called Buddy and learned that he was already rushing to the hospital. My lawyers thought the judge would end the day early if I asked him to, but I didn't want to talk publicly about my daughter. If I wanted permission to leave early, I would need to explain why to the judge and jury, which meant also to the press. And then the next day I would see the inevitable stories that I felt sure would mention her school and the hospital, compromising her anonymity and safety. I was already getting daily harassing and threatening messages on Reddit, and they had started to include my family and get more violent. During the trial, Kleiner had purposely projected a letter with my home address up on the screen for everyone in the courtroom to see. I didn't want to call any more attention to my family, to give my harassers any clues about where my daughter's school was or what hospital was treating her. And so I told Buddy to kiss her for me, and then I'd be there to join them as soon as I could get away. I went back into the courtroom and sat there, trying to keep my face impassive as I was consumed with anxiety and impatience. Luckily, the judge made the decision to let us out early so we could get a jump start on our weekends, The second he ended the session, I rushed through the press throng and grabbed a cab to the hospital, urging the driver to go fast. I rushed into my daughter's hospital room and saw her resting peacefully and Buddy sitting there, smiling.
"She's okay,"
he said, when he saw my terrified face. Relief flooded through me. I hugged Buddy and then lay down on the hospital bed next to my daughter and held her until she fell asleep. Alan's closing argument lasted 3.5 hours in a packed, hot courtroom that was standing room only. He clearly showed, I thought, that I had strong performance in generating money for the firm, and that the men around me took the credit. Alan Powell drove the returns. "The men received the promotions," he said. He described the pattern of sabotage and retribution I faced throughout my last years at Kleiner. He showed how hard it was for women to succeed in the boys' club there. Even, he said, highly qualified, motivated, hard-working women like me. He reminded the jury that Ted said I didn't have the genetic makeup to be a venture capitalist. He showed how my review was falsified, and how they tried to cover their tracks in the process. "In Kleiner Perkins culture," he argued, "when you stand up, you get slammed down." Then, in her closing argument, Lynn put up a slide of me surrounded by 13 pictures of former colleagues. The title was, "Pow's Numerous Conflicts. What is the Common Denominator?" Oh, how that irritated me. In every discrimination case I could think of, one could make that slide, with a plaintiff at the center and all the people mad at her for suing in a ring around her. Does that make the plaintiff wrong? Lynn said that it would be a crazy standard to consider the huge profits someone made for the firm in deciding whether to promote her. To me, that confirmed what I was saying, that in this world, being one of the guys mattered more, even more than making money for the firm. In her rebuttal, Teresa said, "Every individual in this country deserves to have equity in the workplace. Every individual is allowed to have the same standards applied to them." That is what she wanted. She pointed at me. It was true. That's all I'd wanted. Teresa sat down, and just like that, it was up to the jury. It was anyone's guess whether they would find for or against me. It had been a bruising 5 weeks. But I felt like we'd given it our best shot. And we were in the right. I thought we had a chance. Chapter 14. Verdict and Fallout. The verdict came down on March 27, 2015. I could tell by the way the jury walked in, after several days of deliberations, that they hadn't gone our way. Most of the jurors wouldn't make eye contact. One of the jurors who had smiled at me before now looked as though she'd been crying. Others looked dejected. One looked at me angrily, as if I'd offended him personally. The jury said they had voted against all four of my claims. But when Judge Kahn polled the jurors one by one, he found the decision was premature. On count four, that Kleiner had retaliated against me for my complaint, there were 4 yes votes and only 8 no votes. One less than the minimum 9 needed to reach a verdict. Evidently, a juror had changed his mind in my favor on the way into the courtroom, so the judge sent them back to deliberate further. For 2 hours, Alan, Teresa, and I waited, hoping that 5 more jurors would change their minds, but knowing how unlikely that was. "Keep your eyes on the prize," I thought to myself as I took out the statement I had prepared if I lost. It was positive and inspiring and reminded me of why I was here. As the jurors walked in a second time, one who had voted in my favor looked down and hung his head. They returned with a 9-3 vote. The waffler had flipped back. And so it was official. I had lost on all 4 counts. I had known it was a long shot from the start. During the trial, we were outnumbered, We couldn't even afford transcripts to review the proceedings. The press had been so negative for so long before the trial, and though the attitude of the press had gone from disbelieving to understanding over the last few weeks, the change in tone was so late. Plus, a 2013 change in California law had made it even harder to win a discrimination suit. Given all these obstacles, I was prepared for a loss, even if I had a hard time understanding it. By now, I was used to being disappointed in all my experiences fighting discrimination at Kleiner, and here was one more to add to the heap. I hugged my lawyers, who were just as heartbroken as I was. The whole experience was infuriating and heartbreaking. I think if we were alone, we would have howled with rage and sadness. But I had to stay calm and focused. The room was crowded with reporters, and I had a statement to give. I had written one the night after closing arguments, thinking hard about what I wanted people to remember of the trial and how to interpret the loss. If I had won, I wouldn't have said anything, as we were likely to face an appeal process. And I hoped that would be the case. But when we lost, I was happy to have the notes in my pocket, because it let me express the truth of the situation, as I saw it, and thank all the people who had been good to me. We headed to the room in the courthouse that had been set aside for our short press conference, while Kleiner's team held court in the courtroom. I couldn't get away from them fast enough, especially now that Kleiner's lead lawyer was bragging about how her all-girl team had emerged victorious. As we walked down the hall, trailed by most of the reporters, I privately indulged in some Monday morning quarterbacking. I thought of all the things I wished I'd done or not done. I shouldn't have given them all 700,000 of my emails, for one thing. It was just so much fodder to take out of context. I might have had better luck with public opinion if I'd spent more time with the press and prepared a few pages of talking points every day, like Kleiner had. In the first weeks, the big publications went almost entirely in Kleiner's favor. I'd just been trying to get through the day and get back to the office and back to my family. I saw in the aftermath how that had buoyed Kleiner's initial depiction of me as cold and incompetent. Some members of the jury, it was clear, had been reading the press. How could they stop themselves? They had to push through hordes of photographers, videographers, and reporters every time they came in, went to the bathroom, went to lunch, came back from lunch, and went home. I later saw that one of the alternate jurors had tweeted with the popular hashtag, hashtag Ellen Pao trial, even before the trial ended. A clear violation of a juror's duty to refrain from reading or viewing news about the case. I was happy to see that the press had swung more my way by the end. After 5 weeks, the male reporters especially seemed to have a deeper understanding of how VC firms work and how discrimination works. Their articles were more nuanced, had more context, and were less, in my mind, one-sided and incredulous. When we got to the room, I walked straight to the podium, flanked by my lawyers, as cameras flashed and hot lights glared. I could feel the adrenaline pulsing as I faced dozens of reporters. I knew from all the messages I'd been receiving and conversations I'd been having that my supporters would want to see me appear strong and undeterred. And I was determined not to let them down. I pushed aside my own disappointment and read my prepared statement calmly and unemotionally. I want to thank my family and my friends for your love and support during this very challenging time. I'm grateful to my legal team for getting me a day in court, and to everyone around the world, male and female, who has reached out to express support in so many different ways, and to tell me that my story is their story too, and their gratefulness to me for telling my story. I have told my story, and thousands of people have heard it. If I've helped to level the playing field for women and minorities in venture capital, then the battle was worth it. Now's the time for me to get back to my career, to my family, and to my friends. Thank you all very much. My lawyers and I rushed to the elevators without answering any of the questions being shouted at us. We still weren't sure if we were going to appeal, and so we didn't want to say anything more. We still believed in following the rules. Meanwhile, the judge had said the jury was welcome to speak to the press if they chose. I learned later that Marshalette Ramsey, a black woman who had voted for me, told the press that the case had been very emotional for her, and that she hoped it would encourage more women to speak out. She said she believed my account, and that the balance had been very, very close. I felt that there were interpersonal skills or personality traits that were cited in those evaluations on both sides, but depending on how it was worded, it could either propel you to promotion or hold you back, she said. I definitely felt there was a correlation between the timing of the lawsuit and the subsequent termination. She and at least 2.5 of her colleagues had listened to the evidence for 5 weeks and decided I was right and Kleiner was wrong. Their support wasn't enough for me to win, but still, it meant a lot to me to hear that we got close. And messages of support were flooding in. I couldn't even read most of them. The day of the verdict, I received almost 100 messages on LinkedIn alone. Friends from business school and law school wrote to offer support. I'm here for you if you need anything. Even white men in tech emailed me. One of the men who led engineering at BEA wrote, "Regardless of the verdict today, the fearlessness and integrity that you demonstrated through the trial provided a great model for others to follow. You broke a lot of glass." I heard from co-founders from Kleiner-funded companies I had worked with. One wrote that he had been rooting for me and hoped I was okay. Another, Rob Kwok, wrote, "Just wanted to tell you that you're one of the reasons I've kept going at criticism even when things got rough. Every time I've considered giving up, I think about how you believed in us. You're one of my inspirations for making criticism successful and a good company for people to work at." Ninian Wong, a tech CEO founder friend, wrote, "I was quite shocked to see what happened with the case today. I think you did a wonderful service to all women in the tech industry. Maybe this can be like the book To Kill a Mockingbird, where the victory is in the hearts of people, regardless of what happens in the courtroom. Thank you for making it a little bit easier for all of us women in tech." A lawyer wrote to Alan, "I am an attorney at a law firm and I am a woman. Many women in high positions in business, in the case of my friends and me, women at law firms, have been following the Pau case with great interest. The jury's verdict is so disappointing. So disappointing. So much of what I read was what my friends and I have been observing and experiencing for years. For years and years on end. It was all so familiar. I do not need to tell you or any counsel on both sides that they did a fine job representing their respective clients. But if you would pass on to your client a few words of support and solidarity. Je suis Ellen Pell." No matter how abrasive. She's a venture capitalist, for pity's sake. Isn't she supposed to be abrasive? What we want is a seat, on the plane to Vail, at the dinner with the client, at the table around which decisions are being made. Sometimes I don't even know that the seat exists, or that the meeting happened until long after the fact. And if a woman tries to get a seat, she is deflected by subtle criticisms, often behind her back, that she is lacking confidence, and then she is too abrasive, and then she is lacking confidence again, and then she is too abrasive again. Constantly shifting the discussion from behavior of management to her behavior. I am so sick of it. So, so, so sick of it. Maybe the same thing happened with the jury. Ellen Pau is unlikable, so Kleiner Perkins is not gender biased. Just tell her we support her. Teresa Lawless is right. The days of women being told what they are allowed to settle for are over. Or they should be over. I'm damned sorry the jury found the way they did. It was still early in the day when we left the courthouse, so I went back to the Reddit office. When I got there, I tweeted out 10 numbered lines. I left off number 8 as a sort of inside joke on the jury's miscount, writing, "Thank you, world. I have been inspired by the thousands of people who have reached out to me over the past 3 years with support. I've heard from people in Kazakhstan, Bangladesh, Australia, Malaysia, France, Argentina, Norway, Tanzania, Finland, and beyond. Because of social media and live reports, the problem of gender discrimination in venture capital has received attention around the globe. While today's outcome is a disappointment, I take consolation in knowing that people really listened. If we do not share our stories and shine a light on inequities, things will not change. Hopefully, my case will inspire the venture capital industry to level the playing field for everyone, including women and minorities. To support the entrepreneurs of tomorrow, we need to show leadership today. And thank you to the team and board at Reddit for standing by me. In the weeks that followed, I was moved again and again to hear that the case had opened people's eyes to the exclusionary culture of the tech world. People seemed galled, for example, that no one at Kleiner had been able to find a copy of its HR policies, including anything on harassment or discrimination, that the tech industry took such a lax attitude toward human issues, and that deals were still getting done at strip clubs. And I believe that Kleiner and other venture capital firms were shocked that anyone, much less a woman, would take them to court. I think it put a small dent in their sense of invincibility, which is a good thing. I know Kleiner and probably all the other major firms now have mandatory arbitration for all employee disputes. I ran into someone on Kleiner's list of people who were going to testify, and I discovered why he hadn't in the end. He told me that Kleiner tried to push him to testify until finally he said, "Look, if I testify, I have to tell the truth, and I'm only giving the facts." And they backed off. I had dinner with Angela, John's former executive assistant, and Carmen, my former EA. Angela asked me why my lawyer didn't bring her in. She would have testified for me, she said. But I knew it would be impossible for her to get another job as a high-paid assistant if she had publicly testified against her boss. At the same time, Kleiner continued to paint me negatively in the press. They filed to force me to pay almost $1 million in their court and expert witness fees. It was hard to figure out their fees, as they appeared to be trying hard to hide them from the jury. One witness alone was paid $130,000 for his testimony, with an added $280,000 paid to his consulting firm, plus travel costs. That was even after they had knocked off some of the costs, I suspect to make them look less like a bully. I offered not to appeal for $2.7 million, a number that would allow my lawyers to recoup their full costs for their time. It was a number Alan thought they would accept. I didn't think there was a chance, but it was worth trying, because I felt bad that the lawyers had worked so hard with no return. Kleiner shared the number with the press as evidence of my so-called greed, even though I'm sure they knew I would have walked away with less than $300,000 after accounting for my costs, legal fees, and taxes. They wanted silence for their payment, and $2.7 million was a lot less than the $100 million I'd wanted before for my silence. And at this point, I didn't know if I would be able to keep quiet. Having had the opportunity to share my story and to see the impact it was having on others, I didn't see any way to compartmentalize my newfound advocacy and clarity on how discrimination worked in tech. There was no box big enough. Later, in September, when I decided not to appeal, I released one more statement. I have decided to end my lawsuit against Kleiner Perkins. I feel gratified that my actions have encouraged others to speak up about discrimination in venture capital and technology more broadly. I am encouraged that companies are taking more action to quantify and address the disparity of opportunities for women and minorities. To resolve the lawsuit, I will pay Kleiner Perkins for its legal costs as awarded by the court. Although I firmly believe people who bring employment discrimination claims in good faith should not be forced to pay their employers' legal bills. I will also drop my appeal, Since I cannot afford the risk of even more costs to fight against a firm with tremendous financial resources and massive legal and PR armies. To be clear, Kleiner and I have not agreed to settle this matter. Settlement would have provided financial benefits, but at the great cost of silence. To quote their lawyer, KP is not interested in a settlement without a non-disparagement provision. Meaning I would not be free to speak the truth about my experiences. I refuse to be silent on these important issues. This battle has been painful for me personally and professionally, and also for my family. It is time to move on. I look forward to continuing the conversation about workplace equality and to building great companies in the technology industry. In the wake of the verdict, I just wanted to hide. But in the months after the trial, I knew it would be good for Reddit if I did a little bit of press. In April, Katie Couric sat down in our offices to interview me, even though I'd turned her down at first. Initially, I didn't want to do any video, but Katie was visiting her daughter at Stanford and asked to meet with me, and we got along well. She seemed so nice and genuinely empathetic, and she even shared some of her personal experiences with bias in journalism across her entire career. She was warm and professional. So I agreed to my first on-camera interview. I was very tightly wound and found it hard to relax. But she was fair and professional. I respected her and thought the interview went well. In June 2015, I did a Center Stage Recode Conference fireside chat with Kara Swisher. Kara was a longtime reporter for The Washington Post and then for The Wall Street Journal. She co-founded All Things Digital, which she later spun off and rebranded as Recode. Recode's conference was highly respected and attracted top speakers. It was the only non-Apple conference that Steve Jobs would do. Kara is a serious journalist and a tough interviewer, but is also fair. This combination earned her the headline description, Silicon Valley's most feared and well-liked journalist. This time, the conference's main theme was the diversity and inclusion problem in tech. When I talked about how much I hated the pipeline excuse companies give to defend lack of diversity, she chimed in about how she hated unconscious bias as an excuse for doing nothing. Kara knew these issues all too well, having also worked in tech for decades and as CEO of Recode. She later told me the managers on her team had hit a decision point after Vox bought Recode. When two women transferred to The Verge and the conference staff became a standalone unit, Recode's gender ratio went way down from 50-50. Kara's response was to stay deeply involved in hiring and to press her team to try harder. Her own boss, the Vox CEO, emphasized and encouraged slower hiring when it meant adding more women and people of color. It was more evidence of what I've found. The CEO has to drive diversity and inclusion. As CEO of Reddit, I was happy to be back at work full-time. In April, I wrote a blog post asking people to donate to Nepal's earthquake relief efforts. We raised more than $250,000 for two nonprofits in 2 weeks. In June, we were ready to build on the momentum we had from banning revenge porn, so we decided to remove some of the worst harassment on the site. I was looking at stats that showed fully 40% of online users had experienced bullying, harassment, and intimidation. And some 70% of users between ages 18 and 24 said they'd been the target of harassers. Our main problem was that our team feared the community of Reddit users. It was hard for us to manage and resolve problems on the site when we were so scared about our users' reactions that we tried to avoid interacting with them. We only allowed a few employees to communicate directly with users in an official capacity. Some of those employees talked trash about our policies with the moderators on back channels. We ended up with a lot of politics, a lack of transparency, and poor incentives for change. On the site, the powerful combination of an anonymous on-screen-only identity and desire for attention turned many of our users into knowledgeable, committed harassers. They wanted attention,
and they got it.
Any kind of attention was a positive, and they would egg each other on. We knew we had an uphill battle, but we also knew we had to do something before it got inevitably worse. Jessica spent weeks researching subreddits and finally identified 5 subreddits responsible for a huge amount of harassment. The sites we were removing were making Reddit a miserable and dangerous place for people of color, overweight people, and transgender people. They were Fat People Hate, Ham Planet Hatred, Trans F space GS, Neo F space G, and Shit NI space space ERS say. On one of the offending subreddits, Redditors had urged a transgender person to commit suicide. We were clear in our intent and announced, "We're banning behavior, not ideas." We wanted to stop people from pushing others off the platform and preventing them from participating. This wasn't us being the thought police. We weren't touching any of the many, many subreddits giving people a forum to espouse hate of other groups and theories of genetic superiority. That, to my mind, was protected, because we wanted to encourage conversations and ideas. From a practical level, also, defining and removing hate speech would be too hard to do consistently and fairly. If Supreme Court justices and Harvard law professors couldn't agree on what constituted hate speech, we couldn't expect our team to figure it out, even if we trained them for a year. But shaming overweight individuals so aggressively that they were forced off the site? Finding suicidal persons and egging them on to kill themselves? Sexualizing underage transgender kids? Those to me were not the same. Those had real-world consequences. By giving those behaviors bandwidth, we were sanctioning what looked more like actual crimes. Taking these sites down was not done lightly. We discussed it as a team, and I thought about it long and hard. The final decision was that these sites were actively damaging the world and individual people, and we were hosting it. We had an obligation and ability to take a stand. The board was supportive. If anything, they urged us to do even more, and were frustrated that we weren't just taking all the NSFW and controversial content down at once. Possibly hundreds or thousands of subreddits. So certainly for those 5 sites, we had the all clear. That said, I wanted to engage everyone in this decision, especially since they were likely to be harassed themselves and have to defend our actions. I also wanted to have a well-defined, long-term plan for how the subreddits were going to come down, and what was going to happen next. We anticipated pushback and questions, and so we did extensive scenario planning. We had a large set of answers prepared. We knew who was going to handle what topics. If things went completely haywire, we had a crisis communications plan to fall back on, and a full-time security guard. And so we went into the same war room we had used to get rid of revenge porn. We deleted the sites, and we waited. Minutes later, the sites started to pop back up under different names. Our data lead had set up a tracking system with the community team to allow us to spot them. We saw them pop up several at a time, and we pulled them down again instantly. As the harassers realized what was happening, they grew angrier and angrier. They began to retaliate against us personally. My face and body were photoshopped in every conceivable degrading way. One subreddit replaced its banner photo with a devil version of me. I marveled at how much time and talent were going into giving me horns. They added makeup on me, and I considered asking what shade the lipstick was. It looked kind of good. I'd seen a lot of the imagery before, both as a result of the trial and of the revenge porn ban. Me as Chairman Mao was a particularly popular one, though they also sometimes rendered me as Hitler, complete with elaborate Nazi flag borders. They'd Photoshop my head onto an obese person's body and make fun of me for being fat. For the record, as one Redditor wrote, "If anything, she could stand to eat a cookie or two." One had Photoshopped penises in a perfect circle border around an image of me. Most disturbingly, People made graphic rape and murder images and threats against my family and me. We calculated that around 15,000 people were actively involved in the subreddits. But they generated an astounding volume and variety of images. And they prided themselves on their ability to upvote the images so that they would show up all over the most visible parts of the site. Moderators would take down the content, and it would pop back up instantly. The private messages got angrier and angrier over time. The threats and images got more and more graphic. And people were pulling up old addresses and phone numbers, trying to dox me, or finding ways to manipulate Google search results so that typing in my name would yield photos of Hitler or the Islamic State flag. Some of the responses were so repulsive that I've blocked them from my memory. One of the community managers took me aside to show me that one Redditor had offered to pay $1,000 to anyone who took a photo of me getting punched in the face. That was the only post we took down. All that time and energy, I thought. I was working night and day to keep the site up and running, to bring it to mobile, and to make it easier to use, and they wanted to put all this effort into attacking me? What if they used all that time and energy to make an animated movie or write a book or even rebuild our tech infrastructure instead? What a waste. One member of our community team was totally private and had carefully made sure no public photos of herself appeared online. Somehow, they found a picture of her anyway and fat-shamed her on the site. Another person on the team got doxed. They posted her home address and phone number. I have to say, threats carry a bit more weight when the people threatening you also publish your address. Suddenly it goes from online to offline and becomes real. I noticed that only women on the community team were being personally identified and attacked. We were a small part of the staff, and we were catching most of the heat. There wasn't much we could do to stop it, without prolonging or energizing the harassment. Since I couldn't figure out how to provide direct emotional care, I requested that a masseuse come in case anyone wanted physical care. We reminded one another that this was what happens when you fight toxicity. It hits you hard before it goes away. And I praised them privately and publicly for their efforts. It took 2 or 3 long days. But sitting there in that room, we shut those sites down again and again and again until, like a child having a tantrum, the users seemed too weary of reposting them. This was whack-a-mole at its finest. We had so much adrenaline. The planning had paid off. We weren't caught flat-footed. We'd managed the surprises. We'd responded to the users. At the end of that long siege, with the computer wizards smacking down the hate merchants every time they popped up, we had done it. We stared at the screens together. Those guys had moved on down the internet road of depravity. We'd been talking to the press at the same time, and found that the public and most of the Reddit community were with us. It was one of the greatest victories of my career. After the prior few months, losing the case, seeing myself mocked in print and my face pasted onto dictators' bodies, all the ugliness, I'd done battle with one of the darkest corners of the internet. And in this one case, I had won. That was, however, to be my last victory at Reddit. I'd had a good run. In brief, when I started consulting for them, the site had 40 million monthly users. The month I became CEO, we had 135 million. The month I left, we had just shy of 200 million. I grew the user base by almost 50% in 9 months. The site had gone from being a secret club to a real engine for a lot of content on the internet. It was the go-to place for hot new information. We put together a set of company values. 3 of them live on. We sold ads to a car company, and users loved them. We had figured out how to make native ads that worked for both large corporate advertisers and conservative diehard Redditors. Reddit no longer promoted stolen porn or revenge porn. Many other companies followed suit and publicly announced bans on revenge and stolen porn. We had taken the first step and showed it was okay to take that down. We wrote and implemented a site-wide anti-harassment policy. 5 of the worst sections of Reddit were gone, too, and many of the harassing users left with them. You could no longer try to goad other users into committing suicide without being banned. The staff was much more diverse and a lot larger. We hired more women across the board. I had recruited by design a very diverse executive team. 2 Latinx women, a black woman, a Muslim man, a white Latinx woman, an Asian man, and 2 white men. We hired our first black engineer. We brought in experienced product designers and product managers. We added a UX expert from Google and a data scientist from Apple. I noticed that our engineering team had a woman engineer who reported to a woman engineering manager who reported to a woman VP of engineering who reported to me, the woman CEO. I never talked about it with anyone except once with Bethany, who said she too had never before heard of an engineering management chain of 4 women. We'd finally come out with a mobile app, one that won several App of the Year and Design Awards, and a real mobile website. We acquired a mobile app beloved by our most active users. The site was becoming more and more stable. We had finally figured out how to fix a caching issue that had forced us to restart the servers periodically and forced our users to wait 20 to 30 minutes for fresh content. We started an annual privacy report, revealing the numbers of requests for user information and content removal for the first time. I had worked closely with our outside lawyer to create a report that we could share every year and that people could understand. Morale had improved overall, mostly for the people who were open to change. And if some people were still grousing that I'd removed hard liquor from the company parties, I didn't hear about it. People liked the new office. The giant wall murals by Oakland street artists and our own LA designer were very popular. And our full-time recruiter was bringing in a whole new caliber of hires. I brought my daughter to the office from time to time. She loved the artwork, the Snoo mascot, and the Mama Chia drinks Ishan had made an office staple. Other employees brought their families in occasionally as well, and boyfriends and girlfriends and even parents often showed up too. We started performance reviews and improved our process for departures. We had put a lot of time and energy into managing dozens of departures, some voluntary and some not, over the past year. I was proud of what I'd done. Unfortunately, my days too were numbered. The trouble started when Alexis, who was supposed to be leading community and marketing, flubbed an involuntary departure. He decided he didn't want to work with Victoria Taylor, the woman who was leading Reddit's AMAs, Ask Me Anything conversations. I thought she was terrific. I called her the AMA Whisperer. She was really skilled at getting people to be comfortable and natural. She knew exactly what questions to answer in what order. She wouldn't let AMAs be safe and boring or fake and condescending. She wouldn't let publicists do them in their client's place. And she was very protective of the people doing the AMAs, so they were free to take risks. She always flagged anything that could go wrong and helped everyone prepare for various scenarios. When I had required all of our staff to move to San Francisco, I made a huge exception for her so she could stay in New York. There was a lot of conflict around the AMA Whisperer role. Alexis thought the job was easy, and so didn't understand how motivated I was to keep Victoria. I felt that he didn't appreciate the skill and finesse that went into these conversations, or the value of relationships with the AMA moderators. Alexis's actions reminded me of my Kleiner firing, because he botched so much of the process. I had to let him make the decision. He was the manager, and I didn't want to micromanage. Plus, the board had made sure he didn't report to me. But I told him multiple times to be very sure he had someone great to replace her, and had a step-by-step transition plan in place. Users were going to be furious, and we needed to make sure we managed the departure carefully. As it turned out, Redditors weren't just furious about her departure. They were mutinous. They started taking their subreddits offline in protest over losing Victoria and over Reddit's lack of transparency around issues that affected them. We had no way to restore them without making users angrier. The person Alexis had chosen to replace Victoria backed out of the job once she saw the reaction. We didn't even have a chance to announce her as the replacement. Alexis responded by coming online and saying words to the effect of, "You better put those subreddits back up in 12 hours or else." Or else what? I thought. That comment, and a few others, including flat-out mockery using the meme, "Popcorn tastes good," a Reddit inside joke that means enjoying the drama from the sidelines, caused the angry users to double down and keep the subreddits down even longer. Users were organizing online riots. This was the kind of change I knew they hated and took personally. That Alexis had no transition plan in place was a disaster. It was a holiday, the 4th of July, but I was able to get the best communications person in tech to work on a plan with me and our PR person, who was the best at crisis communications. We quickly came up with talking points for Alexis and myself. Alexis, normally a media hound, was suddenly nowhere to be found, via cell, text, Slack, or email. His excuse for not being with me in the office, unbeknownst to anyone else, was that he was at Wimbledon. And his slowness to respond, my PR person suspected, was because he was eager for me to take all the blame for his mistakes. And ultimately I did. The outraged community started a change.org petition to get me fired. They even signed my name to the petition a few dozen times. Some were still mad about my removing the 5 harassing subreddits. Others were angry that the beloved AMA leader was gone. Some just enjoyed the drama. And many more thought we should treat community managers better. For example, they thought we should have given them advance notice about firing Victoria and tools to make it easier to moderate. They had a point. We should have had more direct communication with the moderators. They were doing all the extra work of keeping the subreddits up and running, including the new work of taking down the racist and sexist photoshopped images and posts people were directing at me. And the buck did not stop with me. Alexis was my proxy, but keeping moderators happy didn't seem to be a priority for him. That reflected badly on me. So I publicly took responsibility for the lack of communication, which I had problematically let Alexis handle, and for not showing more appreciation for the moderators' volunteer efforts. Once those factions of the community had turned on me, I knew it was only a matter of time before the board got involved. Loyalists to the site sometimes say Reddit was Alexis and Steve Huffman's baby, but they sold it in 2006 and left in 2009. When they came back in 2014 and 2015 and said they were the parents and should be loved and obeyed, the feral parts of the once-baby-now-child community weren't having it. The board was caught off guard by how mad that community was, and they laid the blame for that anger at my feet. They didn't have the stomach for the community reaction, and they thought Alexis would be able to bring them in line using his founder's authority. In a meeting with 2 board members, it was made clear to me that I should step down. And they blamed the departure on my unwillingness to commit to their growth plan. They wanted me to increase from 135 million monthly users to 350 million in a year. No company had grown that fast except WhatsApp, which didn't have the culture or community problems we had. One board member went so far as to say he wanted me to get to 500 million users. The number was not possible unless we brought back stolen celebrity pictures. And I suspected even then we'd require candid naked photos of every celebrity and wannabe celebrity across the globe to get there in a year. And wondered if he wanted to call Taylor Swift, Beyoncé, and Leonardo DiCaprio to make that request. Because I did not. When the two board members unexpectedly asked me to meet with them, I called my executive coach and told him I was about to be fired. Because the site was doing well, he was doubtful that they'd be getting rid of me, but he prepped me with the advice that, when you think you're going to lose a job, don't agree to anything. Just say you need to think about it. I said I needed to think about it. The next day, a board observer called and said, "You need to resign right away or something bad is going to happen. They said they'll go to Plan B." I didn't know what they had in mind. He couldn't tell me what Plan B was, and I wasn't sure what else they could do to me. I was curious to find out, but in the end I wasn't curious enough. I called a board member and said I'd thought about it and I would resign. We started negotiating my exit. One of my requirements was that Alexis take ownership of his failures publicly. My lawyer handled most of it. And Alexis started happily telling everyone in the office that something big was going to happen on Friday. My executive coach advised me to start writing resignation messages. One for Reddit, one for the team, and one for the public. I started telling my executive team and a few other employees. All seemed surprised. Some cried. Some were sullen. Some were angry. I gave advice and feedback for the last time to team members who needed it. On Friday, I announced my resignation. The board had given me an exit package, and Steve Huffman would be taking over as CEO. During our handoff in front of the whole company, Steve ordered Max Green, the team culture leader, to go find us the coolest bar in town and we'll all go out and celebrate tonight. Some cheers went up. Several people were clearly excited about being able to do shots at an official work event again. Others looked confused and upset. I did 3 scheduled press calls with a board member and Steve. I sent the Washington Post an op-ed, which they ran the next week with the headline, "The Trolls Are Winning the Battle for the Internet." Then I went downstairs, packed the few things I wanted to keep, and left the building. Max told me he thought that having a party so soon was disrespectful to me, but I really didn't care at that point. At the end of the day, I ended up having drinks myself with a few executives. At the Yay Steve celebration, which Max delayed until Tuesday, people got, by all accounts, loaded. There was a lot of bad behavior, and a woman employee was groped. The woman later told me she complained to Steve about it, and he said defensively, "That's hearsay. Do you know what hearsay means?" She asked him, "Do you know what hearsay means?" "It's not hearsay if I'm telling it to you and it happened to me." When I heard the story, I felt crushed. We'd worked so hard to change the culture, and it felt like all that effort had all been undone in one day. Bethany and Ishan publicly blamed the glass cliff for my firing. I found out from multiple sources that Steve and Alexis had been plotting for years to regain control of Reddit from Condé Nast. I was collateral damage. After I left, many Redditors reached out to me, which I found incredibly touching. The woman who did the bear attack AMA sent me a copy of her book describing her successful fight with the bear, her drive down the mountain for help, and other tales of survival. She autographed and inscribed it with, "And I thought I survived a mauling. Keep jabbing your thumb in their eyes, Ellen. You're an inspiration." Hundreds, if not thousands, sent private messages of support on Reddit. Again, many shared stories, this time about how they had been targeted or hurt by the subreddits we had banned. Others said they were sorry they had joined the herd harassing me. As much as I wanted to leave the site forever, I felt a connection to those Redditors and tried to write back to every single one. I even answered questions on the site publicly at one point. I wanted people to know that I was still around and in good spirits. Many Redditors sent gold. Well, Reddit gold. It's a status on Reddit that you can buy for yourself or others to show appreciation for a comment or for their contributions. Or sometimes just to be funny. It costs $3.99 for each month. In the days after I left, the Reddit community sent me almost 2 decades worth. Alas, I couldn't spend Reddit gold out in the real world. And I found myself out of work again after 2.5 years at Reddit. Because of the lawsuit, I was mostly persona non grata in the tech industry. I knew I would need to totally restore and reinvent myself. At Nishan's suggestion, I started kickboxing, which, while cathartic, wasn't enough to make me feel much better about the prior year. My joints and ego ached. I was physically and emotionally exhausted, and I had no idea what would come next. I decided we desperately needed a family vacation. And so we left town on our first trip for fun in ages. For the first time in years, there were no calls scheduled, no emails to return, and no emergencies to handle. We went to Maui to see Lori, my old friend from Google. Our daughter loved Hawaii so much, from her first taste of shave ice to sunset hikes on the beach. And Buddy and I loved being on the beach, watching her frolic in the surf. The stress of the trial, the miscarriage, and all the other crises of the past few years had taken a toll on our marriage. I didn't know what would happen with us. But I did know that, whatever happened, sitting together on the sand watching our little girl laughing in the sun would give us a wonderful memory. We took paddleboard lessons from a famous surfer friend of Lori's. He was zen and curious, Lori had told him, only half-joking, that I was the most hated person on the internet. He told me about almost dying. Laird Hamilton had saved him from a shark attack, and he had the huge scars on his leg to prove it. "A lot of people drown because they panic," the surfer explained to me. "If they could just take 30 seconds to relax and surface, they could get back to shore." I assured him he didn't have to worry about that with me. "It's okay," I explained, "because I never panic."
"People always think that," he said. "But then when it happens, they freak out. You don't actually know for certain what you'll do until it happens."
My friend overheard us and laughed out loud.
"Oh, I know for sure," she told him. "Ellen does not freak out. If she did, it would have happened a long time ago."
Out on the ocean, floating around on my paddleboard on a gorgeous sunny day, I started to relax and feel like myself again. I thought about the box I'd imagined during the trial. All the little experts and witnesses and horrible statements and lies I'd jammed in there so I could get through each day. I'd often asked myself how I would get rid of what I'd begun to think of as the box. The answer had always been, "I'll figure it out later." I wondered if letting go of it here would somehow cosmically pollute Hawaii and the Pacific. Then, after about 15 minutes of lying there relaxed on the board, I visualized the box leaving me. The box floated into the air, and when the sunshine hit it, it disintegrated. Instantly, I felt lighter. I felt free. I paddled back to shore, where Buddy and our little girl and the rest of my life were waiting.
Chapter 15. Project Include. When I returned from vacation, I felt reborn. I was ready to slowly reconnect with my life. I attended to each part that I'd neglected for years. I started by organizing my apartment, cleaning out and donating items from the back corners of closets and storage. I checked in with my dentist and had a crown put in to replace a tooth that had fractured from my stress grinding. I found a therapist that I liked and began to see her every week. I signed up for library and cafeteria duty at my daughter's school. I volunteered to serve meals at Glide Church. I also met with my lawyers to update my will, and I pursued potential angel investments. And I was ready to begin reaching out to people. In August and September of 2015, I met with many of the folks who had shown up or sent encouraging messages during the trial and during my time at Reddit.
I finally came face to face with the women who had been so empathetic because of their experiences with Gamergate. Zoe, Anita, Randy, and Brianna. It was kind of strange meeting people whose connection came from also being harassed publicly. We had this shared, rare experience that none of us wanted, but that bonded us deeply. Conversations with friends were encouraging. But I noticed that each time we met, we also relayed news stories attesting to the slow progress in tech diversity and the ineffectiveness of the attempts to address it. It struck me how similar our stories were. Seeing less qualified men promoted over us, being stigmatized for having children, being left out of meetings and opportunities because we weren't part of the white male in-crowd. The more my friends and I talked, the more we saw that the state of affairs was bleak and depressing. Tech was supposed to be the disruptor, the voice of the future and the engine of innovation. But for 50 years, there'd been an unwillingness to include people with other voices and backgrounds. In fact, over the past 5 years, we'd seen tech culture become even more exclusive and less diverse. The numbers were appalling, and folks in power kept saying the dumbest things about them.